in Racine and Kenosha. It is 40 to the west for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and I am so pleased and honored to once again be sitting opposite Dr. Art Sear, a longtime visitor to the morning show on a nearly monthly basis for well over two decades. And it's always a great privilege and pleasure to be able to speak with him on weighty matters, both here and abroad. His columns appear in newspapers and journals all across the country, and indeed outside of our borders as well. He's penned a number of different articles as well as the book After the Cold War. And we will be talking about a number of important matters over the next few minutes, of course, focusing primarily on these eventful first 6 weeks of the second term of President Donald Trump. And there is no shortage of things to be talking about. And Professor Art Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be welcomed on a cold morning.
Glad to have you here for what...
And a wet one.
Yeah, and glad to have you here for what amounts to your first visit of 2025.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, thank you, sir.
So...
Happy New Year.
I thought that one thing that would be appropriate would be to get from you... just some kind of general comments about these first 6 weeks or so of President Trump's second term. In general, before we get into some specifics, what is your general impression of what has happened, and to what extent is any of it a surprise?
To me, it's very surprising. His first term, I thought, was largely rhetorical. He's always talking, but he didn't actually do much during his first term, and maybe for that reason he's entered office and clearly is determined to have an impact in very tangible, practical terms. So he's doing a lot of talking, as always, but he's also, as everyone knows, been shaking things up a lot.
Right. And I suppose in some respects that was what many of his followers, most ardent admirers, were expecting and wanting from him, and probably wanted and expected that the first time around. And as you're saying, he didn't necessarily shake things up in his first term as much as maybe some people thought he would and hoped he would. And he's certainly making up for that in this second time around.
Quite right. That's very perceptive. I hadn't thought of it that way. Thank you very much. Yeah, that's you're absolutely right now that you've made the point.
So your most recent column is focused on what unfolded in the Oval Office this past week. Was that Friday? What occurred between President Trump and Vice President Vance and Vladimir Zelensky, the leader of Ukraine, something which you call in the very first line of your column a brutal verbal ambush.
Yeah.
First of all, tell us your sort of initial reactions to what unfolded in the Oval Office. And again, to what extent it was unexpected to you.
Absolutely disgraceful. I think there was a signal that an ambush was coming when the vice president was there prominently featured. And there was really a big crowd in the Oval Office, which I think is unusual for encounters of that sort. It's surely unprecedented in terms of a public meeting that is covered by the media. Not a private discussion that is ugly and mean-spirited and demeaning to a very courageous man.
Yeah, you said at one point, you described them as the demeaning insults directed at Zelensky by President Trump and Vice President Vance, probably unprecedented for any public event held at the White House. I mean,
underscoring public. Mind you, I'm quite confident that Lyndon Johnson, behind closed doors, could really rip a man apart. And General Dwight Eisenhower, in many ways the most complicated as well as the most admirable president, in my opinion, since World War II, the genial father, grandfather figure, the smiling golfer, the apparently laid-back president. I know on good authority, not just from what I've read, but from what I've heard, that behind closed doors there was never any doubt that he was the five-star general and you were not. But the leaders I mentioned were accomplished men outside of the media, and the key to Trump, of course, is television and narcissism. And he was heard to say at the end of this chaotic, very nasty encounter with President Zelensky, this was very good television. You know, he was happy. This is reality TV.
Wow. You do take a moment to say in your column that Zelensky, in your words, erred, E-R-R-E-D, erred in the way that he lost his temper, and said that someone who was perhaps a more experienced, seasoned diplomat perhaps could have handled that situation perhaps a bit more, I don't know, wisely or prudently than Mr. Zelensky did. Although you, in the very next phrase, I mean, go on to say, you know, to remind us about what he has been dealing with over the last several years. So you don't mean to be exactly critical of him, but it is part of the story, not just what President Trump and Vice President Vance said, but also the way Mr. Zelensky responded. That's also part of the story.
Yeah, he lost his temper, which is what Trump and Vance were counting on, I'm sure, and their handlers. He's an unusual person. He's not a man who came up through elected politics or diplomacy over the long term. He's obviously a very gifted warrior, But warriors generally don't make good diplomats. Like, ironically, like Trump, he's a man who made his name and a lot of money in the media. I admire him a lot. He and his, my understanding is he and his wife own a villa in Italy. He's got some means. He doesn't have to be doing this.
He doesn't have to remain in Ukraine.
Exactly. No. I admire the personal courage a lot. And when you look at the numbers, Ukraine, a heavily outnumbered nation in every way, has basically fought the Russian army to a standstill and imposed what amounts to a humiliating defeat by making it a stalemate.
Right.
Anyway, I'm in the position of being a Monday morning quarterback and an armchair general, which is what every professor is more or less in every way. But on reflection and the comforts of central heating and the good old USA, I think what Zelensky should have done was say nothing, keep a poker face, what a good diplomat would do. We've seen them do it in all walks of life. And then address himself to the president of the U.S. and, you know, keep talking to Trump, feed his ego, and stay low-key. It's a good way to deal with bosses. You know, you and I have been in the working world for a long time. I was advised many years ago by a man who knew what he was talking about in dealing with a very, very effective but very demanding and at times demeaning boss, particularly complicated entrepreneur, not at Carthage College. He said, you know, low-key it, listen to him. The more you can listen to him, the more he'll run out of steam and the more he'll feel satisfied. You're feeding his insecurities. You reassure him by saying nothing. Americans hate to say nothing. We're jabbering all the time. Our Asian friends, our Native American friends, the Euro-American kind of, you can see why we drive the world crazy, and Trump is... He's kind of an extreme ugly personification of this, in my opinion.
Right.
But, you know, doing nothing, and that's paid off for me in difficult encounters since,
sure.
including at Carthage College and everywhere, low-key it.
So, in some ways, your advice to Mr. Zelensky would have been to be a little less American. In other words, he was, in some ways, American in his response by speaking his mind and without much restraint and so on. I mean, fighting power with power, in a sense.
Yeah, the characteristic response, I don't want to put everything on the Americans. Like I say, he really is a great warrior, a phenomenal man. And if he's suffering from combat stress, or what we call PTSD nowadays, I wouldn't be surprised if he does. It's
right.
Just a tremendous strain.
Absolutely.
And it's endless. The Russians have performed abysmally, but they're not going away.
Right. They've been relentless.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah.
Relentless is the word, and relentless describes Putin.
Right. I know I don't remember from what Mr. Zelensky has said since, but to what extent do you think he was completely blindsided by this encounter with President Trump and Vice President Vance, or do you think walking into that room that did he have any reason to have a sense of what was going to unfold?
I think he was blindsided.
Mm-hmm.
He's not, the politician is always on the alert and always being prepared, the business person as well. And even some professors in certain environments, I think he was blindsided.
Right.
I think Trump set him up by being nothing but friendly and reassuring before coming after him.
Right.
That's just my opinion.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't have any inside information.
Sure. Yeah. Well, in some respects, the gist of your column, in the wake of what you found to be, you know, a truly shocking scene, was to offer up a glimmer of hope, and some of that hope rests with our good friends, the British, and the British Prime Minister, and the possibility that others with maybe less of a vested interest in what is going on will do the hard work of brokering a sustainable and wise sort of peace agreement. Describe this, and I should add that it's something that nobody seems to be talking about, or not at any great length. It's certainly not making the headlines, but you are talking
about
that.
That's why I'm in business, Greg, and still around.
Right.
Yeah.
So tell us what is going on that could perhaps be a pathway to some sort of peace.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm really glad you brought that up. The still new Labour Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, aided closely, I'm sure, by the Foreign and Commonwealth Office and others. The British have a rather integrated government system in contrast to ours. He's been extraordinarily active, largely out of the headlines. But he met with Trump the day before, Thursday, I think, the day before the ambush of President Zelensky. And it was a very friendly visit. I mean, very friendly. And I believe Starmer may have brought a letter from King Charles, you know, carefully planned to feed this ego that they have to deal with. And then the day after the Oval Office encounter, Zelensky went to London. I'm sure this was arranged in advance on Saturday, and had a very positive visit with Starmer. And Starmer raised the matter of using frozen Russian financial assets. There's a lot in Europe. And then on Sunday, there was a summit of European leaders, basically. I don't think the Canadians were there, and we obviously weren't there, but it was NATO members, at least the main ones, without us. And they have agreed in specific policy terms to start very aggressively using these Russian funds, which have been frozen since February of 22, when the invasion of Ukraine, the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, began, to fund substantially increased weapons for Ukraine. Germany has made a commitment to provide very substantial weapons, and I'm sure training and support as well, to Ukraine. That's something very new. Since the Nazi nightmare, Germany has had a very specific, sustained commitment not to provide military support to other countries. They've done a 180. So I believe that the Europeans, notorious for talking more than they act, and Trump keeps repeating this kind of thing, I think they are actually acting in very positive ways, and the British have been a broker in this regard.
I believe you were quoting Prime Minister Starmer when you used the phrase, a coalition of the willing.
Yes.
Describe the circumstances under which he said those words and what he was describing.
Well, he was describing what you and I have been talking about, a coalition of the willing, a kind of backhanded, subtle reference to the unwilling leadership in Washington right now. But those who are willing to go along, we will aid Ukraine. There is some history to that term. It sounds like Churchill to me, but it may well have gone into vogue after the disastrous Munich Conference, 1938. Where the hapless, tragic Prime Minister Chamberlain appeased Hitler, always, always trying to do the right thing. And you see where it led. Yeah, I should have done some homework on that phrase before I came, but it's a significant phrase.
Right.
There's a lot of subtlety, sometimes almost endless subtlety to British leadership.
Interesting.
Keep in mind, they ran the world for a couple hundred years, from the 1700s into the 90s. I mean, they literally did. The British Empire was 25% of the surface of the earth, and a lot more in terms of population when you factor in India and South Asia. So they know what they're doing.
Hmm. Well, one can certainly hope that that this will point the way to some kind of satisfying and just peace between Russia and Ukraine. I think one thing that is interesting to think about is if they are successful, and it's of course a big if, but if they are successful, they will have in a sense circumvented President Trump, because clearly President Trump liked the idea of being the author of the end of this war on his terms. And if this war should be ended through other means, I should think that that would be, in a sense, a disappointment for President Trump, in the sense of it not being something that he himself engineered, although maybe in an inadvertent way he might have caused it.
Well, Zelensky did recover ground. We've been giving the British credit. He deserves credit. I believe the very, maybe on Friday, in any case, before he left the country, he went on Fox News, which might be considered enemy territory and pro-Trump, except it's more complicated than that. And he was interviewed by Bret Baier, who's, to me, not a standard TV type or Fox News type. He tends to be much more of a gentleman. He's an intelligent person who's published some serious books. And that was a civil exchange. And it provided Zelensky with the opportunity to hold out the olive branch to the White House. And without demeaning himself, he made it very clear how grateful he is for U.S. support, as he did in the Oval Office, but how grateful he and his nation are for U.S. support. I don't think there'll be any kind of viable agreement without the U.S. signing on. And my guess is Putin will insist that Trump be involved at some level. At some very public level.
Right. One thing that is interesting about this is that it does play into what has been a theme of President Trump, both in his first term and now early in his second term, and that is his firm belief that the Europeans have not ponied up the kind of resources that he believes they should have been all along. And the thought that, I mean, that what they are considering now would seem to be, at least in part, a response to that criticism. I mean, they are talking about, I mean, albeit frozen Russian assets, but nevertheless, this would be Europe playing a more, even more significant role in what is going on between Russia and Ukraine.
That's nothing new. Disputes and policies, as some of the other articles I sent you getting ready for today. We might want to move on from Trump at some point.
Sure.
The NATO alliance was set up in 49. In 1952, there was a conference in Lisbon, Portugal, a crucial NATO ally, a dictatorship that's geographically very, very important. And NATO made a commitment to certain levels of contribution to the alliance, and they didn't meet them. Throughout the history of NATO, it's been a history of most of the members not meeting their spending goals. The British generally do, and Poland, a new member, Greece, Latvia, I believe, they've actually been, these are all very new members except for the British. They've all met their spending goals, but generally the Europeans have not. Mind you, an awful lot of American defense aid is spent in the United States. It's designated for NATO, but in fact the money goes to U.S. arms manufacturers and merchants. The U.S. military-industrial complex gets a lot of money that's designated as NATO money. We are the largest military power in NATO. We've got the largest army, except for Turkey, and it's a lot of it is deceptive.
Interesting.
But I'm sure the Europeans will get their act together more than they have as a result of the Oval Office encounter.
Right. It was really interesting to read, and this is now we're on to a second column, and I had never heard about the Lisbon goals of 1952.
Well, you have now.
Thank you very much.
It's how I stay in business, Craig.
Right. Well, but it was also interesting because, I mean, when President Trump has leveled his, you know, withering criticism of the European members of NATO for this very thing, I don't ever remember him making, you know, specific reference to this agreement from, you know, well more than a half century ago. But so, I mean, in a sense, there is grounds for some criticism.
He doesn't get briefings, as presidents usually do. No, he has no sense of history or any interest in it.
Right.
Very unusual American leader.
Right. As we're talking about this issue, I mean, and NATO and so on, of course, you always are appreciative of the importance of some historical context. And one of the things that you talk about is that the United States and Britain have a very close relationship, and that the British have often been quite influential in how the United States has acted in the world. And I think some of us, probably as Americans, probably smugly assume that the other way around is much more the story about how, you know, we, the much larger nation now, are typically the ones directing how everything goes. But Your column really points to a more complicated picture in which we should not underestimate the significance of the Brits as our partners, and their influence on the way our country has moved through the world in recent years.
Yes, well, thank you. The fact that Britain is a middle power, it's a small country, and they no longer have their empire, they do have a very effective military. But the economy is perpetually plagued with all kinds of problems. And leaving the European Union under Boris Johnson, who was kind of their version of Trump, about five, six years ago, has certainly added to their problems. But it was really the 20th century that transformed our relationship from one that was in many ways hostile to and distant and suspicious to this very, very close partnership. George Bundy, President Kennedy's national security advisor, used to refer to the British as someone to talk to, and that's absolutely a friendly ear, people who do understand us more than other foreigners, because our heritage in terms of our institutions and dominant culture is very much British and Anglo-Saxon, certainly not continental European. The World War I was the initial pivot point. The Zimmermann note was a note from the German foreign minister or foreign office, I believe, emphasized the importance of building an alliance with Mexico as a way of undercutting the United States over the long term. They got a copy of that and shared it with the Wilson administration, Woodrow Wilson administration, I believe, also leaked it to the media quite intentionally. And that, along with the German declaration of unrestricted submarine warfare, we're going to kill anything, including neutral ships, made it unavoidable that we would enter World War I on the side of the Allies, not the Central Powers. There's a big debate in this country, including in Wisconsin, with a large German population. There was a lot of sentiment in that war that was pro-German. And even more dramatically, well before we entered World War II, the British were working on getting us in on their side. It's quite a fascinating story where intelligence operatives and services played a big role on both sides.
Right. And You in this column characterize our relationship as always close, despite some severe strains from time to time, and it is a fascinating history. We should all know better. For those of you just joining us, my morning show guest today is, of course, Dr. Art Sear. By this point, he needs no introduction. A very, very familiar voice on the morning show. One of the matters brought up in another recent column was an announcement by the president that new and higher priority would be given to an advanced missile defense system, which in some other nation, I'm forgetting where, it is described as an Iron Dome.
Israel.
Israel, okay. although I mean, I think you characterize this announcement by the Trump administration as startling and dramatic and so on, but your column points out that in fact there have been extensive conversations about this sort of thing for quite some time. And do I remember that all the way back to the administration of President Eisenhower?
Yes, indeed.
There have been this possibility has at least been raised.
Yeah, well, the contest between offense and defense is old as the history of warfare. And early in the Cold War, before intercontinental ballistic missiles appeared in 1960-61, our great fear was Soviet bomber attack over the North Pole. North American Air Defense Command, close rapport with the Canadians, developed for that reason, and we developed very effective anti-aircraft missiles, Nike Zeus. It was a continuing debate. Eisenhower controlled, who coined the term military-industrial complex, he controlled the military by putting a ceiling on the total defense budget and then telling his former comrades-in-arms, you fellows are the experts, you take care of working this out. They were at each other's throats ruthlessly. This was the defense budget was more than half the total federal budget in the 50s.
Wow.
Vastly more than today.
Wow.
And defense intellectuals and ambitious politicians, including John F. Kennedy, took advantage of the chaos that ensued organizationally to criticize duplication of effort and inter-service rivalry, which was seen as a bad thing. With 2020 hindsight, it's clear that that's how I kept a lid on what is the most powerful and, by definition, the most inherently dangerous interest group in the United States, as Ike said in his farewell address. Kennedy's domineering defense secretary, Robert McNamara, brought in a whole slew of mostly civilian younger PhDs, all young men, I believe. And they immediately created tremendous hostility in the Pentagon. McNamara was emotionally as well as intellectually offended. This man who believed the world should be one big organization chart and data should explain everything and drive policy. By the duplication of effort by the three militaries, so he dictated almost immediately that the Air Force will have land-based missiles, the new ICBMs that were just coming in. The Navy will have submarine-based missiles, which are just coming in and basically invulnerable. And the Army, you're out of the game. They had been, by definition, particularly interested in and involved in defensive weapons of all kinds. By 1968, Lyndon Johnson was in desperate, 67, even before the Tet Offensive, Lyndon Johnson was in desperate political trouble thanks to Vietnam primarily. McNamara had, I believe, a physical and emotional breakdown and just was no longer able to function. Effectively, Johnson very graciously and generously named him president of the World Bank, Tom Clawson's predecessor. But he also forced McNamara to announce that there would be an anti-ballistic missile system, and the Army would, in those days, the Army would take it over. So defense was back in the game. McNamara also was struck by the obvious fact that it's incredibly difficult to put together a defensive missile system. It's like hitting a bullet with a bullet,
right?
The way it's described. We've done it, the Israeli Iron Dome, and actually we've had defensive systems now for many years. The ominous change is the militarization of space. Eisenhower was extremely successful at keeping space exploration a civilian enterprise. He thought that military test pilots made the best astronauts back then. But he wanted civilian NASA to be a civilian agency, and it was. Lyndon Johnson, who had a close working relationship with Eisenhower, there are very poignant photographs of LBJ clearly in bad shape toward the end, seeking out Ike, consulting him, taking him on Air Force One to ask him what to do. Lyndon Johnson got a space treaty passed that recognized by the UN that demilitarized space. Most unfortunately, Ronald Reagan was transfixed by the idea of the Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars, as it was called, and took the first steps towards militarizing space. And then Trump, in his first term, announced the Space Force. So we're going to have more and more weapons and more people in uniform, I'm sorry to say, involved in the space race.
Right.
And when military services and Elon Musk get together over the long term, I'm a little concerned about what might come out at the very end.
Right.
I hope this is clear. It's very complicated, but it's very important.
Yeah.
It's really important history.
And one thing I'm struck by as you describe this history is, in a sense, the irony of a military man like General Eisenhower, then President Eisenhower, insisting that the military not be part of the space program. I mean, it just seems like at least the knee-jerk response of the typical military man would be military involvement in just about anything is bound to be a positive thing. And he had the wisdom to see beyond that and to see what I suppose he thought were potential threats to the ultimate peace of the world if space exploration itself became militarized.
No, again, with 2020 hindsight, he was hardly the typical military man. He had a great capacity to bring out the best in people and inspire people. FDR and General Marshall saw that, which is why they jumped him up over a large number of more senior generals. Ike had just got his first star to command Torch, the invasion of North Africa. He brought out the best in Richard Nixon at times. And Nixon's eulogy to Eisenhower, he in effect compared him to Washington and said he was first in war, first in peace, and first in hearts of his countrymen. Americans do not like, generally, to elect military men to office, the top office. And you've got to be quite unusual to overcome that.
Right. Well, President Eisenhower is our last general to be elected president, correct?
I think that's right. I think that's right.
Right. So
Barry Goldwater was an Air Force general. The Air Force has always pursued the star system, find actors and politicians getting high rank in the reserves, but you're quite right. That's me being picky.
Yeah,
the last general.
We are speaking with Dr. Art Sear, and we are touching on a number of different events and issues, and I hope we'll have a couple of minutes maybe at the end of the hour to talk about Mr. Musk and the prominent role that he is playing in this current administration. But first, I want to give you a chance to touch on another column of yours that you wrote relatively recently. In fact, this might have been the first column you published after the inauguration of President Trump, in which you make reference to a whirlwind of some of what President Trump did, even in the hours after his inauguration, let alone in those first days and weeks. But go on then to talk about how remarkably stable the stock market has remained through all of this tumult, at least by and large. And particularly when one thinks about the longer historical picture of past turbulence, there is a general stability that we should be grateful for.
That column was a month ago, long predating the current drop in the markets.
Well, true.
I compared it to the Great Depression, the historic stock market crash in 1929. It hit bottom in 1932. It was around 321. numbers that seem bizarre by today's standards.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, 29. People would never guess you're talking about the stock market. I mean,
Yes, invest in stocks over the long term. That's my brilliant investment advice, over the long term. The gold and silver will pay off for even over the longer term. That's 100 or 200 years. Think of your great-great-great-grandchildren if you want to spend money on that stuff. But stocks pay off. And I'm quite confident that will continue. Don't hold me. I think it was around 321 and 29. It lost 25% in one day. Mm-hmm. And then went up and down, up and down, and then hit finally rock bottom in, I think, 42 dollars.
Wow.
Volatility in 7-8 contrasts with the basic stability that we've had in recent years. I don't know what the markets are going to do, but we do have a cushion of wealth, a structure of wealth. We have trillions of dollars in private assets in the U.S. They are growing dramatically. We far outpace China. Russia is an economic basket case and getting worse. Economically, we have the resources to survive a lot, including ourselves, including the election of Donald Trump. We survived the 60s when that cushion of wealth was a good deal smaller. That was a far more violent and turbulent decade than today. I think that's the point I was trying to communicate. Mm-hmm. And comparison with the Great Depression is a way of getting across just how enormously wealthy we are. Now, if there are people of any age listening to this program who are out of work and have been out of work or have suffered a tragic death or are in a horrible situation personally or employment or both, this isn't going to be very encouraging or inspiring. But speaking collectively, we have gigantic, unbelievable, historically unbelievable private assets in this country.
And I think what you're saying is there is a way in which all of us, or nearly all of us, benefit from that, if not directly, in terms of just the general health of our economy. Is that what
you're saying? Yes, and the stability of our system. We've been talking about the military. If Trump actually ordered officers to, you know, have the army take over the Congress, or actually did try to order a military coup, I don't think he will. But I'm confident they would not follow those orders. We are so rich in this country, we can afford irresponsibility at the top, which is the only way I can describe the behavior of Trump and Musk and their sledgehammer approach to trying to reduce government.
Right.
It also reflects on the genius of the founding fathers of this country. We do have, by design, strict division of powers, and we do have the rule of law. The president seems to be going wild currently with tariffs, among other things. But ultimately, my understanding of the law is that ultimately Congress, the president can impose short-term tariffs, but ultimately Congress has to get into the act, because it's in the Constitution that tariffs are actually a function of the legislature. Congress has given up a lot of power to the president, ironically mostly Democrats seeking to expand progressive government. Trump is now testing the limits of this. It may prove ultimately to be healthy, because if Congress is able to become less lazy, frankly, in terms of actually getting things done, as opposed to rhetoric and scheming and wheeling and dealing, if Congress can be more assertive, that will be a very healthy result of this, to me, very unattractive and disturbing initial Trump administration.
Right.
I hope that's clear. I'm obviously expressing opinions well beyond facts, but basically congenial to an NPR audience.
I wonder if you would mind just saying a word about Mr. Musk and the role that he has played thus far in this second term of President Trump. And was this something that we should have anticipated? I think some of us were frankly caught by surprise.
No.
And the central and very visible role that he seems to be playing at this point. this point. What do you make of the presence of Elon Musk in this administration and the role that he is playing?
The president's interested in disrupting things, and Musk is willing to be a disruptor. I obviously have to respect, and I personally admire, his undeniable entrepreneurial skill, especially with SpaceX. We were dependent on Russian rockets to get our people up to the space station before SpaceX put us back into the space exploration game. I do know something about management after all these years, including private sector management, having observed a lot of it, and I've been involved in nonprofit management throughout my life. You don't get good results by demeaning people. You don't get good results by treating people badly. And why Mr. Musk feels compelled to operate like such a bully and publicly degrade and demean people who happen to work in the public sector, I honestly don't know. But it certainly serves Trump's purposes, and it's what Musk, who can do anything he wants to within the law, it's what Musk wants to be doing at this point. It'll be interesting to see. I'm not sure the planet or the solar system is big enough for both Mr. Trump's and Mr. Musk's egos, so we'll see how long they stay as buddies. I do think the Elon Musk show is going to get very old very quickly. Incredibly wealthy man pushing people around, demeaning them, insulting them.
Right.
And trying to get them unemployed. That show is not going to play for a very long time with any popularity at all.
Right. It will be interesting to see. And, of course, it's not as though, I don't think, Donald Trump and Elon Musk, it's not like they are lifelong friends. Those are not two names, I don't think, that we've particularly associated with one another. So this is a relatively new relationship, and time will tell if it flourishes or withers as time goes on and as life and events become still more complicated. Well, as usual, we've explored some really interesting things today, thanks to your expertise and perspective, and I deeply appreciate your presence on the morning show today, as always, and look forward very much to your next visit. Dr. Art Sear, joining us today on WGTD's morning show. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, Greg, for your insights and your courtesy.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we will be celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Racine Literacy Council. And joining me will be, first of all, Laura Sumner Kuhn, who is the current executive director of the Racine Literacy Council. And we will be finding out about all that they have going on to celebrate this great milestone. With us will be Ann Zog, one of the small army of very capable and committed volunteer tutors who are part of the Literacy Council, and also Victor Mejia, who is a client of the Racine Literacy Council. And he and his wife and daughter have participated in one of the newer offerings of the Literacy Council, the Family Literacy Program. And he will be giving us his perspective on the importance of the Racine Literacy Council at this point in time. On Thursday, I'll be speaking with three members of the Kenosha Police Department, and they are concerned primarily with scams and frauds perpetrated over the internet. And this, of course, is a scourge of modern life, which seems to be getting worse by the day. And the three of them have made a number of presentations to various groups trying to highlight the dangers of this kind of activity and what ordinary citizens can do and should do to help safeguard their safety from such fraud or scams. And so we will be talking about that on Thursday's morning show. And then on Friday, I will be speaking with a British psychologist who's the author of a book called The Tree That Blends, which examines something that in some circles is thought of as something of a dirty word, flexibility. And it is his contention that flexibility is one of the things that we need in order to truly succeed in life. So that will be on Friday. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today will be cloudy and mild, and we will have intermittent rain most of the day with a high of 53 degrees. Cloudy and rainy tonight with a low of 45. More of the same tomorrow. Cloudy, windy, rainy with a high of 49 degrees. By Thursday, we are promised sunshine, still mild conditions. We could see, however, on Friday, a bit of light snow. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.